I'm going to share with you my thoughts on the Kotel Compromise. In 1967, when Yerushalayim was reunified under the Jewish state, Israel, the Kotel Maravi was administered by virtue of the 1967 Protection of the Holy Places Law by the rabbi of the Western Wall since 1967. And this law states that the holy places, which includes the Kotel Maravi, shall be protected from desecration and any other violation. So the rabbi, the rabbi of the Western Wall, was in charge to make sure there was no desecration, no chilul to the Western Wall. Now, in this law of 1967, the Minister of Religious Affairs, the Misrad HaDatot, was charged with the implementation of this law. Now, this holy site, the Kotel Maravi, adhered to the customs of Orthodox Judaism, separating men and women, with women being precluded from wearing tefillin and the talis and from reading from the Torah. In 1988, during the first International Jewish Feminist Conference in Yerushalayim, a group of multi-denominational women came to pray at the Kotel with a Sefer Torah. Soon after, a group of women formed the Women of the Wall, and this group demanded that freedom of prayer be given to women at the Kotel. And as part of this struggle, women pray in the women's section of Rosh Chodesh, some wearing talitot and some wearing tefillin and some trying to bring a Sefer Torah from which to read. There were a number of legal battles, and the court wanted the government to come up with a plan to make arrangements for these women to pray unhindered. But that was to no avail until finally in 2003, Israel's Supreme Court instructed the Israeli government to prepare the site of Robinson's Arch to use for non-Orthodox services. The site was inaugurated in August 2004 and has since hosted services by Reform and conservative groups as well as Women of the Wall activists. However, Reform and Women of the Wall activists consider the location to be unsatisfactory, in part due to the designation of the park as an archaeological site and resulting restrictions on access and worship, and in part due to their perceived treatment as second-class citizens and their exclusion from the Western Wall Plaza. In 2013, Natan Sharansky proposed a solution for resolving the controversy, calling for the renovation of the site at the foot of Robinson's Arch to make it accessible to worshippers at all hours of the day. Under the compromise, the 1967 Protection of Holy Places Law would be amended to read, quote, local customs of the site, i.e. Minhag HaMakom, will be based on the principles of religious pluralism and gender equality. Prayer in the site will be egalitarian and unsegregated, women and men together without a partition. On August 25th, a new platform was completed, and this era is called Ezrat Yisrael. And at the end of January of 2016, the government approved the compromise according to which this area was supposed to be expanded and its management was to be handed over to a public council that would include non-Orthodox representatives. Meanwhile, the Haredim threatened to quit the government in response to the plan. And the government revisited the plan and it was frozen in June of 2017. Now, Natan Sharansky, in September 6, 2016, wrote an impassioned plea in an article where he writes the following. Given the situation, the compromise reached over the Kotel was truly remarkable. After 3.5 years of intense negotiations, initiated and fully supported by the Prime Minister, the Rabbi of the Western Wall, and representatives of Reform and Conservative Jewry, together with the leadership of the Women of the Wall, had agreed to reimagine our people's holiest site in a way that would be inclusive and respectful of all by creating a separately administered egalitarian prayer space alongside the traditional one, together united by a single entrance. This agreement granted legitimacy to liberal communities while acknowledging that Orthodoxy remains Israel's de facto religious common denominator. The proposed arrangement in turn received the support of a huge majority of the Israeli government. The compromise thus reflected in a highly visible and even tangible way Israel's capacity to unite the Jewish people. The Kotel is the symbol of our national existence and the heart of our religious life. The fact that we can literally make room there for everyone consequently shows that our differences need not divide us. The party's commitment to a shared future with Israel as our common home could have inspired future cooperation on a host of other issues as well. Instead, we may be abandoning a uniquely hopeful agreement to a uniquely disastrous failure. The demise of the Kotel Compromise would be devastating for two reasons. First, never before has we seen so much energy and goodwill invested in such a negotiating process. Never before has the Prime Minister been so personally involved, and never before has the government itself stood officially behind such a solution. If under all of these circumstances we still cannot manage to implement a lasting agreement, what does this say about our future as a people? Second, Israel and world Jewry are fighting together against various efforts to delegitimize the Jewish state, including the BDS movement. One of the main tactics of these efforts is to distance young Jews from Israel by convincing them that it is illiberal and retrograde. In short, that it is not a home for them. By failing to offer these Jews a respectable place in our public square, we are effectively telling them their communities are not welcome here, confirming the message they receive from our adversaries at precisely the moment when we ought to be bringing them closer. Therefore, to abandon the Kotel agreement now is to legitimate extremism, to alienate large groups of fellow Jews, and to allow discord to further poison our public life. With Israel facing unprecedented attacks on the world stage, and with anti-Zionist sentiment routinely used as a pretext for anti-Semitism, we are weakening ourselves at an especially vulnerable moment, playing directly into the hands of those on the outside who could truly do us harm. Anyone who cares about the future of the Jewish people should care about this issue. We must not simply throw up our hands, but rather take action now before it is too late. And again, despite his impassioned plea, once the Haredim threatened to quit the government, this plan was frozen about 5 years ago. It seems that this issue is mostly an issue for American but not Israeli Jewry. Even though if you would poll Israelis, a high percentage of Israelis, mostly secular, are in favor of a place for egalitarian prayer section at the Kotel, it is not a high priority for them. They are more interested in issues like civil marriage and restrictions on public transportation on Shabbos. It's become more of an issue for non-Orthodox U.S. streams of Judaism. Most Orthodox rabbis did not support this plan. However, some progressive Orthodox rabbis expressed support, such as Rav Shlomo Riskin, Rav Yuval Shurlo, and Rav Benny Lau. Fast forward to last year, when Naftali Bennett became Prime Minister of Israel, and he had the majority to pass the Kotel Compromise, and there was some talk that the Israeli government would move forward with implementing the plan. However, in December, Religious Affairs Minister Matan Kahana told his aides that they have decided not to deal with the compromise now, as his focus was on kashrut and conversion reform, because those were issues that directly affected secular Israelis more so than the Kotel issue, because it's not such a big issue for secular Israelis to go visit the Kotel and pray separate men and women. Meanwhile, Orthodox organizations lobbied to convince the Israeli government that not all diaspora Jewry is in favor of the Kotel Compromise. Websites like SaveOurKotel.org and OneKotel.org were created to gain signatories and funding to thwart this compromise. Now, what's the problem with having a place in the Kotel where non-halachic prayer will take place? Is it a halachic or hashkafic problem? And maybe the problem is very simple. How can we allow such a holy place to be defiled by this kind of worship of men and women praying together? Now, does the Kotel have Kedusha? You know, Shai Agnon, the famous Israeli author, he would not touch the stone of the Kotel shortly after the Six-Day War because of the holiness of the of the stones. There's an article in Yediot Achronot from Monday, June 26, 1967, which said the following. Yesterday, Shai Agnon was careful not to touch the stones of the Kotel with his hands. These stones are remnants of the Mikdash, too holy to feel them with our bare hands, said the author. Agnon, who returned from America a few days ago, arrived at the Kotel accompanied by Mayor Teddy Pollack. Agnon was very moved, and the whole way Walking down from the Jerusalem municipality office to Shar HaShpot, he shared memories and pointed out alleyways he used to traverse together with his wife Esther week after week. Generations ago, explained Agnon, those who came to the Kotel would remove their shoes. I myself, who lived in Yerushalayim for almost 60 years, never touched the stones of the Kotel. One Chag, I gave a Jew standing next to me a machzer to use during davening. When he was done davening, the Jew left it resting on the stones of the Kotel. And since then, I have not touched the machzer, even though it was old and valuable. Agnon impressed upon Teddy Pollack to do everything in his power to create a unique atmosphere of holiness next to the Kotel, and to meticulously clean the area surrounding it in order to engender respect and dignity in the eyes of its visitors. He also suggested to stop the numerous photographers from congregating on the Kotel Plaza and turning it into a movie set. A young man wrapped in talis and tefillin who was davening at the Kotel at that time approached Agnon and requested an autograph. Agnon disapprovingly rejected his request right next to the Kotel. And to ask for an autograph while you are wearing talis and tefillin? Agnon shared that in New York he acceded to the request of a Jew for an autograph, but that was in exchange for a $10,000 donation to Israel. Agnon mentioned to Baruch Duv Devani, the singer of Kuk Zatzal, some hearts are like stones, and some stones, like the stones of the Kotel, have the status of a heart. Agnon expressed his approval for plans to dig deep in the ground in order to unearth additional layers of the Kotel stones which had sunk over the generations. However, he expressed extreme disapproval to Ben-Gurion's suggestion to raise the wall surrounding the old city of Jerusalem. Ben-Gurion already has done many foolish things, and among all the great things he initiated, there was no shortage of nonsense. But this suggestion is the greatest folly of them all. So he didn't touch the stones of the Kotel. But the question is, does it really have actual Kedusha? There is a Midrash in Shmos Rabbah, Parsha Beis, Siman Beis, with Sayyid Rav Acha, who says, La'olam eina shechina zaza mikotel maravi, that the shechina does not leave the kotel maravi, and he cites the pasuk in Shir HaShirim, Hinei ze omed achar kos leinu. This is standing behind our wall. There's a midrash in Bamidbar Rabbah, Parsha Yudav, Simon Beis, which also cites this pasuk, Hinei ze omed achar kos leinu. This refers to the kotel maravi. She'eino charev la'olam, Lama she'ashchina b'marav. So again, telling us that the Shechina is in the west, in the Kotel ha'amaravi. The truth is, the Radvaz, a 16th century Egyptian rabbi, who wrote a tshuva in his tshuvos chelek beis simon tuf reish memches, explains that what this means is that not that the Kotel itself has the Kedusha, rather the Makom, the place of the Kodesh HaKadoshim, remains holy even after the destruction. In any case, Binyamin of Tudela, who was a traveler, lived in the 11th century, and he wrote about all his travels. So he records that in his travels, he witnessed the Jews of his time called the Kotel Shar HaRachamim, and they would go there to daven. In his Sefer Kaftor Vaferach Rav Ishtori HaParchi, a 14th century physician geographer, identifies the Kotel as one of the walls of the Har HaBayis. In 1929, the British did not allow the Jews to set up a machitza at the Kotel, and they imposed other restrictions because of complaints from the Muslims. And Rav Kook voiced tremendous opposition to the move and declared a public fast. He wrote an article where he states that we are an old nation, that we have endured tremendous suffering, and our survival is attributable to a strong neshama which expresses itself in the world through Torah and the Beis HaMikdash. And the only remnant of the Beis HaMikdash is the Kotel, so it must remain under Jewish control. But the question is, what is the halachic status of the Kotel? So the Radvaz, who I mentioned before, is famous for identifying the location of the Evan HaShtiyah, the place where the Kodesh HaKadoshim once stood, as under the Dome of the Rock. And he also implies that the Kotel is the wall of the Azara, of the Mikdash. And if that's the case, the Kotel is the actual Kedusha. Now, the Chachmas Adam in Shari Tzedek, Yud Aleph Sif Ches, he was one of the leading halachic authorities in the 19th century, 18th and 19th centuries. He writes very clearly that the Kotel is the wall of the Azara. And there's a Rav Yaakov, the Ritvaz, Rav Yaakov, David Vilovsky. So he lived 50, 60 years after the Chayyadam, Rav Danzig, and he writes, so the Ritvaz writes that when he visited the Kotel of Yeshua Yosef Kalbo, they weren't sure whether they could approach the Kotel, because maybe it's part of the Azara. And Ravelvel Soloveitchik, the Rav's uncle, was strict about this position. He wouldn't touch the walls of the Kotel. However, other poskim disagreed. Rav Avadia Yosef in Yabia Omer Chelak Hey Simon Yerodea Simon Chav Zayin, he mentions that there are a lot of difficulties with the position of the Radvaz that the Kotel Maravi is the wall of the Azara. So, because if you say that the Evan Hashtiyah, which is that's the Kodesh Kodashim, that's where the Dome of the Rock is, and we know that from the Evan Hashtiyah, from the Kodesh Kodashim, to the wall of the Azara was 11 Amos. So, that can't be. So then, the Kotel Maravi is much more than 11 Amos. He writes, he says that it's about 80 meters, which is more than 160 amos, from the Kodesh HaKadoshim to the Kotel Maravi. So if the Kotel Maravi cannot be the wall of the Mikdash, the wall of the Azara, Rav Yechiel Michal Tukachinsky in a work, Ha'ir VeHakodesh VeHamikdash, Chilak Dalet, page 20, he says that even though the Radvaz's opinion that the Kotel is the wall of the Azara, that was never accepted. And even though there are some contemporary post-link, the Ritvaz, who were concerned for his opinion, the minhag, the custom, is always to, you can go up close to the Kotel without concern that it's part of the Har Habayis. And Rav Soloveitchik in Kinos, Misora Sarav, Soloveitchik writes the following, and is noteworthy, that the Western Wall is not referred to at all in the Babylonian Talmud or the Jerusalem Talmud, and is hardly mentioned in the Rishonim. For example, the Rambam's letter describing his arrival in Jerusalem does not mention anything about the Western Wall. There is a reference to the Western Wall of the Midrash on the Pasuk from Shir HaShirim, Hinei Omed Achar Kosleinu, that Metzitz Min HaCharakim, Hashem looks, pierced through the lattice, through the windows. The Midrash says this refers to the Western Wall, and the Shechina is behind the Western Wall, and its shadow. From Soloveitchik writes, I have always been somewhat skeptical of the authenticity of this Midrashic references to the Western Wall, and I suspect they may be of a later period because the classical Talmudic sources make no mention of the Western Wall. In my view, this Kina of Rabbi Elazar HaKalir is one of the earliest documents in which the Western Wall is mentioned. So it seems that the general consensus is that the Kotel has no Kedusha as being the wall of the Mikdash. So how do we view the Kotel area? So Rav Yitzchak Yosef and Yaakov Yosef Dine Harabayis cites a Taz who feels the Kedusha of the Kotel as that of being the largest shul. The sanctity of the Kotel is that for thousands of years Jews have prayed there, cried there, poured their hearts there. They feel a sense of connection to God like no other place in the world. It is holy insofar as it is a thousand-year-old place of prayer. And so with that being in mind, this Mesorah, this tradition, will continue under the compromise, if this compromise would take place, because those men and women who wish to pray together will pray in a different place at the Kotel, where there is no Kedusha of people praying there for thousands of years. The Kotel is more than a Beit Knesset. It's a national symbol and a national shrine. It is a place where IDF soldiers are sworn in as a symbol of their role in fighting for a thousand-years-old people. Is a place for all Jews, religious and secular, to connect with their roots and find a way to connect with God in their own way, which will sometimes differ from ours. I think that why our community, at least some in our community, struggle with whether we would be in favor of or opposed to a cultural compromise is that our community cares about three things. We care about humanity, we care about the nation, we care about Kedusha. We're liberally minded, we're religious Zionists, and we're also Orthodox. We care about being inclusive, we care about being loyal to the land and the state of Israel, and we are, we believe in our sacred duty to observe the mitzvahs and to hold our tradition. And I think that anyone who thinks that there's an easy answer to this question, yes, compromise, no compromise, does not struggle with these three values. Because if you're a religious humanist, you want to find a way for all Jews to find some connection with God at the kotel according to their comfort level, not feel like second-class citizens. Even though you can say, well, this is our tradition in the kotel, if someone typically prays mixed, men and women together, they're going to feel like second-class citizens, and you feel for them. If you're a nationalist, you want to find a way to achieve compromise so the nation is unified. If you're Orthodox, you ask yourself, how can I allow what is viewed as the holiest prayer site to be defiled in such a way? Maybe you argue that maybe creating peace at our spiritual center is a virtue of the highest order. And Yerushalayim is the Ir Shechubra La Yachdav, says the Pasuk at Tehillim. It's a city that's supposed to connect us, and yet the Kotel, unfortunately, has become the symbol that divides us. Part of me feels we've waited so long for Medinat Yisrael and Yerushalayim and the Kotel, now we're being so petty. Just give the non-Orthodox a spot away from the Kotel to stop the fighting. Part of me feels the secular Jews in Israel really don't care. Solving this issue will not solve the unity crisis. So it's not going to do anything in reality. And if I felt that this would solve unity and bring about unity amongst all Jews, but I'm not sure if that's a realistic assumption. In any case, how often do the non-Orthodox visit the Kotel anyway? Part of me feels that maybe if we create another prayer space by the Kotel to be administered by non-Orthodox rabbis, then are we potentially opening the door to non-Orthodox involvement, rabbinic involvement in religious matters in Israel? And part of me feels that the best way to deal with non-Orthodox clergy is to leave them alone in this regard, let them do what they want to do, because the market in Israel favors the Orthodox, and secular Israelis, for the most part, either want Orthodox rabbis or nothing. They're not interested in conservative reform rabbis, so giving them something at the Kotel doesn't seem like it will have any long-term negative impact on the strengthening of the non-Orthodox in Israel. I personally am torn between my emotions telling me how can we allow foreign worship at the Kotel to my emotions telling me to just give this to the non-Orthodox to achieve peace. Although I must admit, even if there were a compromise, again, would this really lead to peace? Or would this simply be a short-lived peace and a perception of empowerment by the non-Orthodox clergy in Israel? When we think about the Kotel and the compromise, which does not look like it's happening anytime soon, I do not believe that this is a halachic issue. I view this as a hashkafic issue. I view this as an issue where I'm confronted with conflicting Torah values that do not present a clear answer. And my hope, at the very least, is that whatever position you take on the issue, you try to fully appreciate all the factors at play which push in different directions.